Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop on this Tuesday, May 5th. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us today is Dr. Amish Adalja of Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. His work focused on emerging infectious disease, pandemic preparedness, and biosecurity. He is here to answer your questions about the coronavirus. And if you have a question, give us a call early. It should be a very busy program. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Amish Adalja and your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us today is Dr. Amish Adalja of Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. Dr. Adalja has served on U.S. government panels for the treatment of plague and anthrax in mass casualty settings and the system of care for infectious disease emergencies. He completed two fellowships at the University of Pittsburgh, one in infectious diseases, one in critical care medicine. He completed a combined residency in internal medicine and emergency medicine at Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh. He is a graduate of the American University of the Caribbean School of Medicine, and he obtained a Bachelor of Science in Industrial Management from Carnegie Mellon University. His work is focused on emerging infectious disease, pandemic preparedness, and biosecurity. He is here to answer your questions about the coronavirus. If you want to be part of the conversation today, 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us as well. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. The number again is 800-348-2551. Dr. Amish Adalja, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You have served on government panels looking into some very serious topics, somewhat germane to what we are experiencing now. And before we get to our calls, in your opinion, has government, both local and state and federal, have they done enough in the years leading up to this to be prepared?
No, they have not. This is something that we've been warning about for decades and decades, writing reports, speaking about this, trying to warn the country about what would happen if we were not adequately prepared for a pandemic. We had given direct actions, recommendations, things that needed to be done in order to avoid the situation that we're in today. And sadly, most of that was ignored. And we've been in this cycle of panic and neglect where every time there's an infectious disease emergency, there's a lot of panic and a lot of talk. And it's all kind of reactive, nothing ever proactive, and then they forget about it. This happened after anthrax, after H1N1, after Zika, after Ebola. The same thing keeps happening over and over again. And we've seen cascading failures with this pandemic, and it didn't have to be this way. We wouldn't have to have all of this economic shutdown if we would have handled this outbreak from the beginning. Remember, this is 17 years after SARS, the first coronavirus to really cause a dangerous outbreak, and we have no SARS vaccine. We have no coronavirus vaccines, no coronavirus antivirals. 17 years kind of squandered.
Have we learned lessons that you perhaps, with some level of optimism, think we will change our ways going forward?
This pandemic has touched everybody in this country and on this planet. So I do think that this reinforces the need to prepare for pandemics before they happen, to take actions that in retrospect are very cheap compared to what we're spending now in order to try and control this outbreak. So I do think that there are lessons that are being learned. I think now those policymakers that were complacent and didn't really realize the risk of a pandemic have really seen what this can do and how disruptive it can be, or what type of loss of life occurs when you don't prepare for something. So I am hopeful that this is going to leave a major mark in the minds of policymakers, and this becomes a national priority to make sure that we have the capacity to deal with these infectious disease emergencies in the future.
Dr. Amish Adalja of Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security is our guest today. Before we get to the phones, in your estimation, is a state, and you don't have to be specific about which one, but which state, or are there states that have gotten it right and those that have not gotten it right?
Well, in the United States, I think it's important to remember we have kind of an asynchronous, heterogeneous outbreak. So some states were relatively spared based upon their population density, based upon how much preparation they've gotten in place ahead of time, and whether or not they were unlucky enough to be a hotspot. And I do think that some states have been very proactive and have preserved their hospital capacity, have been able to keep their health departments resourced enough to be able to do case contact tracing, and are in a much better position than other states. And it varies. And I think that you're going to see this throughout the pandemic, that some places are going to be better prepared. And unfortunately, we haven't had great federal leadership on this. So it's been up to states and governors and local policymakers to be able to do most of the response here. And I think we've seen a varied response across the country.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Dr. Adalja, 800-348-2551. Let's go over to Patrick in Beach Lake, Pennsylvania. Patrick.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. You're on.
So my question is, how long will the coronavirus last, and how long will it really take to develop a vaccine for COVID-19?
Sure. So this is a virus that's established itself in the human population, meaning that it's endemic. That's the word we use. It's now something that's spreading efficiently from human to human, and it is not going to disappear until we have a vaccine. This is now one of the viruses that we are going to contend with on a day-to-day basis. And that's important as we move forward, because this is going to be a risk that we have to think about and incorporate into our daily lives. Vaccine is the only way that we will get this threat off the table. But vaccine development is something that's usually measured in years, not in weeks, not in months. And while we have a timetable for having a vaccine in 12 to 18 months, and there is now this Operation Warp Speed trying to develop manufacturing facilities even before we have a vaccine candidate, and we are moving at breakneck speed to get a vaccine, we have to realize that 12 to 18 months is probably a very optimistic assumption, because there is a lot to do. We're using lots of technologies that haven't been used for vaccines. We're going to need to understand what the dose of the vaccine is. We're going to need to understand how long the vaccine lasts. We're going to need to know the side effect profile, because we're going to be vaccinating a lot of people. I mean, technically, basically, the entire world needs to be vaccinated. So if there's a side effect that happens in a very small proportion of people, we need to know about it, because those are going to be real numbers when you actually vaccinate 8 billion people. And we have to be able to manufacture this on a large scale, larger than we've done for anything, really. And that's going to take time. So I think 12 to 18 months is in the realm of the possible, but it is optimistic in my mind.
Patrick, thank you very much for the call. In your estimation, doctor, why is this one different? In other words, you have been looking at these sort of outbreaks and worse for years. We had SARS. You mentioned anthrax. What triggered this level of almost panic worldwide among governments?
What we have here is a virus that spreads efficiently from person to person through the respiratory route. So when you look at ways that pathogens can spread from person to person, if it's through the respiratory route, that's very hard for anybody to intervene on. It's not like you can fix it with sanitation or fix it by killing mosquitoes. This is something that we do. We breathe all the time. We talk to people all the time. That's something that's part of our daily life. So that makes it very efficient to spread. And then what you saw was the fact that this was a novel virus and there was no population-level immunity, meaning the entire world's population was susceptible to it. That's what's different about this. We've got a novel virus, no immunity in the human population, that spreads efficiently through the respiratory route. That, by definition, is a pandemic pathogen. That's something that you have to take seriously. That's something that you cannot let spiral out of control. And unfortunately, it did spiral out of control. And that's what set off the panic when we saw human-to-human spread in China, where we heard about hospitals being inundated in Wuhan and the same thing happening in Italy. That's what sparked the panic. And it was a justified panic, because this was a true pandemic emergency. And it has been one of the most challenging, it's going to be the most challenging infectious disease outbreak that we've dealt with probably in a century.
Do you believe in any way China was too opaque with regard to the early stages of the information release?
I definitely think that China was too opaque. We know that this virus was initially described to us as something that wasn't transmitting from human to human, yet their first cases that occurred that they tried to link to a seafood market, some of those cases weren't linked to the seafood market. So we know that this likely had been spreading in humans at least since mid-November. There was alarm bells rung by doctors there. There was one doctor who posted something on his the alumni group of his medical school. He was actually prosecuted for that. He's since died of that virus. We know that reporters from the Washington Post, from the New York Times, from the Wall Street Journal have been expelled from China. We know that there is now a moratorium on publishing on the origin of the virus. There's been a lot of clampdown there of information in China. So I don't think that they have been as transparent as we thought they would be. They did release the sequence of the virus very quickly, which was a good thing, but the rest of this has been kind of a lot of obfuscation and propaganda that's been emanating from China. So we have a lot of reasons to not trust everything we're hearing about how this outbreak unfolded in the beginning stages. And if we would have known more earlier, hopefully we would have been able to take better action. But even when we did know what we know, there still were mistakes made in the U.S. So it's not all – it's not everything would be perfectly better if China was more transparent. It certainly would have helped things, but and their opaqueness has made it worse and has led to conspiracy theories that may or may not be true.
Dr. Amish Adalja of Johns Hopkins University joins us today. Doctor, we'll take a quick break here, and then we'll get back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Dr. Amish Adalja of Johns Hopkins University is with us today. And a few emails here, Doctor, and then we'll jump back on the phones. This one came in from Robin. And Robin writes, Governor Cuomo talks about bed occupancy numbers in hospitals. Part of reopening for elective surgery is maintaining 30% of beds for COVID-19 patients. Is that 30% of a hospital's original number of beds or 30% of the increased number of beds he had hospitals move to early on? I believe they had to add 50% capacity at the start of the pause.
My understanding is it's what their current bed capacity is, how many licensed beds they have in their hospitals. And this is an important metric that we want to know, we want to keep in place, because that's been the whole overriding concern here, is that we did not want the cases to occur at such a rate that hospital capacity was overwhelmed. And as we start to lift social distancing measures across the country, we are going to see more cases, we are going to see more hospitalizations, and we're going to see more deaths. And the key metric has to be keeping those cases to a level that are manageable by hospitals, so hospitals don't have to go into crisis. And I do think having a 30% buffer is a good metric to use in places, especially where there were hotspots like in New York.
This one's from Barbara. Barbara says, so many of us were very sick earlier this year. We had flu shots. Any chance we'd show Corona-19 antibodies? Lots of us seniors are wondering, and that's from Barbara.
We definitely know that this virus was circulating undetected in the United States and other places around the world, and likely mixed in with our cold and flu seasons. How early that was, we don't quite know. It looks like, for example, the earliest data in the United States was that this likely was here maybe late December, definitely obviously in January where we had our first cases. And France is also showing cases that were occurring very, very early. People that were actually sick around Christmas time in France who had not traveled to China. So it clearly had left China by December. So there is a chance that some individuals who got sick in December, in January, likely had this and recovered from it. And antibody testing will be important to actually determine whether or not someone got infected. So it's in the realm of possibility, and I would not be surprised that we find more cases the more we look.
One more email, and then we'll get back to the phones. This one is from Howard. I read earlier today that the virus has mutated into a more aggressive, more contagious form. If so, and it continues to mutate, how can an effective vaccine be developed?
So it's important. I know the paper that the writer is talking about, that paper hasn't been peer-reviewed yet. It's something that people have put out preliminarily. So it's important that we make sure that the science is actually vetted. We do know that all viruses mutate. Coronaviruses tend to mutate less frequently than other viruses. And it's important to track mutations and see if those mutations change the function of the virus. So far, there's not been any evidence. This paper that came out earlier is the first one. I haven't seen any other data that shows that there's differences in virulence, meaning differences in how severe patients are or whether or not this has mutated to a point where it makes it hard for vaccines. We know that other coronavirus vaccines that we use in animals, for example, in cows and in bird species, have been stable and have not been made obsolete because of mutations. It's going to be something that's really important to follow over time and see. Right now, I wouldn't panic about that, but I think it is an active avenue of research that we have to follow.
Dr. Amish Adalja of Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security joins us today on this Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. Bob in Broad Auburn. Bob, you're on.
Thank you. A few decades ago, Linus Pauling, the two-time Nobel Prize winner, wrote a book, in addition to The Nature of the Chemical Bond, wrote a book titled Vitamin C and the Common Cold. Ascorbic acid, according to Linus Pauling, toughened cell walls of the body and made it more difficult for viruses to inject codons into the cells and thus reproduce. Does the doctor have any information on the benefit, possibly, of vitamin C, ascorbic acid, found in fruit juice and fruits?
Doctor.
So vitamin C has been something that people have talked about for many different infections. And I would say as of today, there isn't any strong evidence that unless you're vitamin C deficient, which most Americans are not, that it provides any benefit. There is a clinical trial going on to use vitamin C in severe patients that are infected with the coronavirus. It will be important to see if that works. We've tried to use vitamin C for other conditions like sepsis, and they haven't really shown, there haven't really been a big benefit shown with vitamin C. There is some biological plausibility to it. However, we haven't seen data, and I think it's important that we actually do randomized controlled trials before we recommend something like vitamin C to individuals. I don't expect that you're going to see a big result on this based on other data with vitamin C, but it will be important to complete the clinical trials that are going on.
Bob, thank you very much. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Dr. Amish Adalja of Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security is with us today. Steve is in Lubbock, Mass. Steve, you're on.
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much. I've got a couple of questions with regard to, you actually sort of, you addressed them a little earlier, but they're basically arising around the role of China in all of this. Now, I understand that there is a sense that has been delivered by the American intelligence to the effect that this was not a man-made virus, and that this likely arose in the marketplace. But one of the concerns I've got is that because they have destroyed a lot of the early proof that they had, I think in the form of animals that were that were maybe infected with this this virus and other things that were destroyed in order to, how do you, would you imagine the issue of future epidemics being sort of nipped in the bud when you're dealing with a with countries, say for instance like the like China, which has the Chinese Communist Party, which I happen to view as really a autocratic dictatorial way of and how can we get around that in order to get to these causes and address them if we're dealing with countries like that? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Doctor.
Sure. So there definitely is a problem when you have a country that's not being transparent, when it is insular, when it is autocratic, when freedom of speech is suppressed by scientists. So that is something that we're going to have to contend with in the future. It's not just China. Imagine an outbreak in North Korea. That might be the same way. We've seen cover-ups of outbreaks everywhere. It's kind of a natural tendency of many countries to try and cover up their outbreaks. And China had done this with SARS before. I think it's going to be very difficult for us to figure out exactly who patient zero was and where the origin of the virus was. I think the most likely explanation is that this came naturally from bats to some other animal. We're actively trying to figure out what animal that was into humans and then had the ability to spread efficiently. I do think that that the whole issue has become very politicized now, and it's become very hard to actually know what the truth will actually be. But I do think that the most likely explanation is this is a natural outbreak. But it also goes to the fact that these countries that are autocratic and not do not respect individual rights are going to be a major place for infectious disease outbreaks to occur. And they can spiral out of control, and we never get the truth. And the same thing has happened, for example, in Venezuela with cases of malaria and measles. So this isn't something new that autocratic governments try and cover up their infectious disease outbreaks and then become hotbeds of infectious disease outbreaks.
Steve, thank you very much for the call. Do you think that it is important, Dr. Adalja, to find out who patient zero actually was?
From an epidemiological standpoint, yes, I do think it is important because we want to know how this person got infected. What was the animal reservoir? Because we know that this all coronaviruses naturally reside in bats, but it's important to know what the pathway was, because is this an animal that people interact with regularly? Is it something that they consume? Is there better ways to handle that animal if it's being butchered? We want to be able to put in biosafety to understand what it was. So I think it is important to understand at least what the animal reservoir was, where it spilled from bats into. And I do think knowing when patient zero first occurred and understanding how that outbreak went from one person to, you know, millions of people, that's really important because we want to understand what the early dynamics were. And was there a point where you could have intervened, and how would you have intervened? So I think from an epidemiological standpoint, it's very important to try and understand the origin of this virus. We may never completely know it. And the more we look, the more backdating we're seeing. For example, with France and now the first case in China likely occurred in mid, I think November 17th was the first documented case. So I think it's really important to know, but it's going to be very difficult.
Now, we understand the issues with dictatorships. Has the flow of information, in your estimation, been decent as far as between the states and between the Western democracies?
Yes, I do think that there's been tremendous sharing between the Western democracies and those parts of the world that respect individual rights, and we have seen collaborations across countries happening. There's even collaborations going on with China. I would say that this isn't the scientists trying to hamper things. It's actually the government in some of those places. But I do think we've seen good free flow of information. We have multiple countries pursuing vaccine candidates, multiple countries doing trials of antivirals. So I do think there has been collaboration because this really is a pandemic that's affecting the entire world, and we don't know where all the solutions are going to come from. They are not going to come from just one country, and it's really important that everybody collaborate as best they can and that we come to look at this as something that we are all striving to do. And I think that the free flow of information between countries is going to be really important as we deal with this pandemic in the months and even maybe even years to come.
Dr. Amish Adalja of Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security joins us today on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. Richard in Schenectady. Richard, you're on.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Dr. Adalja and Ray.
Hi.
My concern is a lot of people think they're younger now and they hear the phrase compromised immune systems and they figure, well, that's not me. I'm healthy. I don't have any heart issues. I don't have any breathing issues. But my thinking is if it comes around in the fall during flu season again, is it possible somebody could contract the flu even if they didn't show many symptoms? And would that be a compromising would that compromise their immune system that such that they could get the flu and then be a lot more susceptible to the more serious effects of the coronavirus if they got that also? Could they get both?
That's a good question. Yeah, so it's a good question. We don't have much. There definitely have been viral co-infections that have occurred. So somebody could have influenza and they also got this coronavirus. There have been case reports of that around the world since the start of this pandemic. We don't have any good data yet at this point to know whether these dual infections are worse or are they the same or does one virus dominate in the other. But I do think that there's reason to believe they could act synergistically and there's also reason to believe they might interfere with each other and you get a less severe infection. So I think this is something that has to be studied in detail, but it is a possibility that will occur, and I'm sure will occur in the fall, that we will have co-infections, which we've already seen with this virus. But I don't think we have any good data to be able to say exactly what the clinical course of such a person would be at this time.
Richard, thank you very much for the call. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. We talk about the coronavirus today with Dr. Amish Adalja of Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. And Nancy is in Walden, New York. Nancy, can you turn your radio down a little bit?
Yep, it's off.
Okie dokie, you're on.
Okay, so here's my question. If we re-engage life and we go with the CDC and the state regulations, and we stay 6 feet apart and we wear masks, we still have not eradicated the virus. And so people are still going to get it. So how would someone someone who's older go about living their life and not getting it?
So that's going to be a very challenging proposition, because we know that this virus isn't going to go anywhere. Like I said, it's established in the human population. So there are going to be vulnerable populations, the elderly, those with other medical conditions, who are going to have to be very careful going forward, because the virus is here, we don't have a vaccine, and they are going to be at particular risk for getting a severe case, ending up hospitalized, or maybe even dying from it. So what we're going to do is you're going to see relaxation of social distancing, but I do think that there's still going to be strong recommendations and guidance that those that fall in those vulnerable groups are going to have to continue to social distance as best they can. And they are going to have to, it's going to be something that we're going to have to be really mindful of, especially going forward with nursing homes, for example, where nursing homes are still going to have to be basically on lockdown because of the danger that the virus poses to that age group. So this is going to be something that we're going to have to live with, and it's going to have to be something that we are careful about. And each person is going to have to be very mindful of their exposures as we move forward, because as social distancing leaves, the virus is not going to leave.
Nancy, you want to
follow
up?
So I'm over 60. Yeah, so I'm over 60, and right now I'm working from home. And I don't know how I feel about, you know, even with the regulations, 6 feet apart, face masks, it leaves me as a vulnerable person. I'm happy to stay home, but not everyone is able to do that. So they're just calculating more deaths.
Yeah, it's inevitable that there are going to be more deaths from this. And again, you have to remember that flattening the curve was really about the hospital capacity and making sure that our hospitals are able to deal with the number of cases. This is a horrible choice that we're left with, because this virus was not contained appropriately in the beginning stages. We ended up with an outbreak that spiraled out of control, and now we're behind, and we're still going to get cases, we're still going to get deaths, and we're left with the simple fact that there are people that are going to continue to die from this, and that will likely be the case as we start to increase the activity in our economy. And it's going to be really important that people stay home if they can stay home, if they're in those vulnerable groups. And
forever?
Until there's a vaccine, or until there's sufficient herd immunity that this becomes less of a risk, or we develop better treatments that decrease the need decrease the complications of this. We have one drug that's got an emergency use authorization now that helps you improve faster, but it's not a knockout punch. But I think that this is going to be something that people are going to have to put into their risk profile every day and think about. And we do this for other things, and this coronavirus is going to be an added cause of it. And it's unfortunate that this happened, but we're kind of left with this situation because this virus was not handled from the get-go at the appropriate way.
Explain. Now, we have about 45 seconds before our next break, but give us a quick 101 level course on what herd immunity is and what it will mean for getting back to quote-unquote normal.
Herd immunity refers to the level of protection or resistance that a virus or any kind of pathogen may face in a population, because so many people have been exposed to it that it cannot find new victims to infect. And for a virus like this, you need to probably have at least 60% of the population with immunity, either through a vaccine or through their own prior exposure. We're not there yet. Even in the hardest hit parts of New York City, we're around maybe 20%. That's what we mean by herd immunity. So the higher the level of immunity is, then you can kind of cocoon yourself amongst those people. And we rely on that, for example, with measles. Where people who are not able to be vaccinated can rely on the fact that everybody else has been vaccinated, so they're not at high risk.
Dr. Amish Adalja of Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security is with us today on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. We are extremely lucky to have Dr. Adalja for a whole hour, and the home stretch is straight ahead. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. The number to call is 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. Amish Adalja of Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. And a couple of emails here, doctor, and then we'll hit the phones up till the end of the program. This one's from Ellen. Interesting question. Ellen writes, I get frustrated by people who seem to underestimate the broader risk of the virus. If hospital care were not available, what would the mortality rate be? And what is the current proportion of people in their 30s and 40s that have died even with hospital care?
So I would say that for the vast majority of people with or without hospital care, this is a mild illness. I think that's true, that 98%, maybe 90% of people have a mild illness that doesn't even require them going to the hospital. The people that we worry about are those that are in the higher risk groups, the ones that require hospitalization. And there you're seeing those people, hospitalization can be life-saving. So I do think that the mortality rate would still be not something like on an Ebola level of 50% or anything like that. I think that the mortality, the top max of this mortality might be, if there were no hospitals, maybe 10%. In younger people, I think that the hospitalization rate is very low in younger people. The death rate is very low in younger people in general. But those that need hospitalization need hospitalization. So I would say that I couldn't come up with a rate because I don't know what the there's not good numbers to do that from. But if you need hospitalization and you don't have hospitalization, it is life saving. Is basically the point I would come back to on that.
All right, this one is from Joe in Colony. Joe writes, about 6 months ago, there was a report on the news that we are close to a vaccine that could immunize against all viruses. Were they speaking of not having to create a new flu vaccine every year or not having to create any other vaccines? Is there a snowball's chance in hell of us seeing such a thing this century? And that's from Joe in Colony.
I think he might have gotten a couple things mixed up when he heard the news report. What I think he might have been hearing about is a universal flu vaccine, a flu vaccine that you could take once or maybe once every 5 years that protected you against a broad range of strains and not require you to get the flu vaccine updated every year because of the strain changes that happen. I think that's likely what he's referring to. You obviously couldn't have a vaccine for every virus because viruses are very distinct from each other. They come from many, many different families, and you wouldn't get cross protection across viral families. So a coronavirus vaccine will not protect you against influenza and vice versa. But there are efforts to make a universal flu vaccine, which would be game changing when it comes to influenza.
And this one is from Laura. Can you please address the occurrence of stroke in young adults following COVID-19 infections? Is there any new information on the clotting abnormalities associated with this virus and precautions to take?
So there have been reports of strokes occurring in healthy people and older people with this virus, even those who have mild symptoms. And what we can best determine is that this virus, when your immune system reacts to it, causes a clotting cascade to occur in some individuals that can lead to clots. It's important to remember that young people getting strokes are extremely rare. They have occurred, but they're not the normal course that you face when you are a young person with this disease. However, if you are somebody that has these types of symptoms where maybe you're having difficulty finding words, one of your arms isn't moving, one of your legs is weaker than normal, you need to call 911 immediately. And it's also important for clinicians to realize that young people can get strokes because of this. But I do think it's important to keep it in perspective and in context that this is a rare complication, and it's something that we have to watch for and monitor for, but it's not something that every young person is going to get or needs to be extremely worried about.
Okay, and Laura also adds, there are new reports on Kawasaki's disease in children, which may be linked to the virus. Any thoughts on that?
Sure. So Kawasaki syndrome is kind of a poorly understood syndrome that happens in children, likely an autoimmune type of phenomenon that occurs. And there have been reports of Kawasaki syndrome occurring now. Not every case of these Kawasaki cases that are in the press now that are being talked about are positive for coronavirus. So it's important to remember that we haven't proved causation here. This is going to be important to look at, especially the fact that some of these patients that have Kawasaki syndrome are not positive for the coronavirus. So that may point to another cause. But it is suspicious that this is happening coincident with large numbers of cases. So I think it's something that we have to follow up and understand and figure out if there is a mechanism that this virus can provoke Kawasaki syndrome, because we don't even actually have a cause for Kawasaki syndrome overall. Nobody really knows what causes it.
You know, you mentioned looking back on this and drawing conclusions. How many years will that take after all of the worst of this passes?
I suspect that there are going to be people that devote their whole research career to understanding this coronavirus. So I do think it's going to be, information is going to continue to be learned about this virus over the next 5 years for sure. I think that you're going to see a lot more explained about why this did what it did and how it does what it does in people, and what the immune system signature is of this, and what the complication rate is and what the risk factors are. So there's a lot of work to be done to understand this novel virus.
All right, final question here, Dr. Adalja, from the email, and then we'll get to the phones. Patrick writes, how did we contain SARS and to a point Ebola, yet are having such a social dilemma containing COVID-19?
It's a great question, and I'll start with Ebola first because that's an easier one to answer. So when you look at viruses, and I alluded to this earlier, the way that they transmit is really important for how easy it is to contain them. So let's go back to Ebola. Ebola is transmitted through blood and body fluids. And if you're a virus, that's not very good to transmit between people, because you have to be pretty close to get in touch with someone's blood and body fluids. So Ebola is deadly and scary, but it's not very contagious. So all you really have to do is put in barriers to people's blood and body fluids. That means gloves and masks when you're taking care of these people. And in Africa, where Ebola outbreaks occur, often burial practices where people are bathing a dead body, that can expose them to body fluids. You just stop all of that, and then Ebola basically disappears. It's not that contagious. SARS is a little bit different. So SARS is another coronavirus. It was actually the third human coronavirus that we discovered. And SARS is very similar to this virus. Genetically, the virus that causes COVID-19 is called SARS-CoV-2. So it's very similar. But the thing about SARS is it doesn't get very high numbers inside your nasal passages. So it's not as contagious from person to person. It caused about 8,000 cases around the world back in 2003. But the fact was, it was really using healthcare settings to transmit. And healthcare workers often are exposed to body to nasal secretions and oral secretions in a way that the ordinary person is not. Mm-hmm. So if once we figured out how to take care of this in the hospital safely, and we were able to isolate these people and do contact tracing, the fact was it wasn't contagious enough to actually be an issue. It did have some explosive outbreaks that occurred within that big outbreak, what we call super spreading events, where there were people that disproportionately infected a lot of other people. But if you look at it as a whole, it really wasn't that contagious. So that's why it was able to be contained. And that's not the case with this virus, because if you look at the amount of virus that's in a person's nose, it's much higher than SARS.
Because we were able to contain SARS, and largely, as you say, because it was not as infectious through the nose, is there any hope that whatever we used as therapeutics or stopping SARS in a medical setting can be applied to this coronavirus?
Well, there are some general principles that, in terms of how you take care of these patients, making sure that your staff have the appropriate personal protective equipment, making sure that you're isolating patients from other patients, all of that is definitely applicable. But the fact is, SARS was something that was transmitting in hospitals and healthcare facilities, very, very dramatic outbreaks, for example, in Mount Sinai in Toronto. This isn't doing that. This is spreading in the community. This is spreading just outside casually with people, not casually, but when people are interacting with each other in their day-to-day life, when they cough and sneeze on each other. SARS wasn't doing that. That's the issue. The SARS was something that was a hospital-based type of infection. That's the story of SARS. This is a community, SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19 is a community-based story, where this is a virus that's spreading in the community, which is very different and much harder to intervene on than in hospitalized patients.
I understand what you're saying. My question was about treating individual patients. In other words, when someone came down with SARS, what did you do? What pharmaceuticals were administered? How did you treat that patient?
There are no treatments for SARS. There is no antiviral against SARS. There's no specific treatment for SARS, just like there is not for this virus. So it was all supportive care for SARS.
And what was the mortality rate of SARS?
The mortality rate of SARS was much higher than COVID-19. The mortality rate of SARS was 10%.
When will we actually know the mortality rate of this one?
We have some good ideas of what the mortality rate is now, and we know that it's less than 1%, probably closer to 0.5%. The only time I think we'll really know for sure what this is when we do large sero surveys like you guys are doing in New York State, and being able to kind of do the math and understand what the true denominator of infection is. So I think that that's going to be probably within a year or several months, we'll have some better idea. But we're getting closer and closer to it as our testing capacity has increased around the world.
Dr. Amish Adalja of Johns Hopkins University for Health Security is with us. And let's go to Robert in Margaretville. Robert.
Yeah, hi, Ryan.
Margaret in Robertville. No, it's Robert in Margaretville. Go ahead.
That's it.
You got it.
Great. Thank you for taking my doctor, thanks for taking my question. So I moved from Howard County, Maryland, over the past year to upstate New York. And this past January, I signed up for insurance. And I couldn't find a primary physician. So as far as pandemic security, is this a common problem? Because I called my insurance company. They weren't able to find me anybody. They found me a doctor's assistant, and they asked me to come in and get paperwork, but they said they're not taking any patients for 3 or 4 months. Is this a common problem? And what are the effects if doctors stop taking on patients?
All right, doctor.
So what we've seen with this pandemic is that many routine healthcare issues have kind of faltered. And you have a lot of outpatient clinics that are not seeing patients for routine care, and everything has really been shifted to emergency care. And that's going to be something that's going to be part of the story of this pandemic, that when we started to respond to this virus, it caused a lot of other healthcare needs to be put on hold, including primary care. And we know that you can't postpone those things forever, and that we need to get our hospital clinics working again. We need outpatient clinics. We need people to be able to get their colonoscopies, their breast cancer screenings, their cervical cancer screenings. All of that stuff needs to happen. And I think that this is something that's an unfortunate consequence, that when you struck with a very broad stroke and caused an economic shutdown, there were many health consequences to that, especially when it was hospitals that were delaying routine care. And I think that this is going to be one of the first things that we get back online. And hopefully you'll be able to get in and see a physician sooner rather than later. But this is something that probably didn't necessarily need to happen everywhere. Clearly, some hospitals in New York City were over capacity and could not do this. But not every hospital in the country or in the state needed to completely cancel all routine care, because this is going to leave a measurable mark. And we're going to see upswings in other chronic conditions in time, because of the disruption that the pandemic caused.
Let's go to Steve in Albany. Steve, you're on.
Hi, Ray and doctor. Actually, what you were just saying feeds right into my question. We've been hearing a lot about the death rate from the virus, but that it seems to me there are much more complicated relationships between the virus and the death rate in general, the total death rate. And so I'm wondering if there are data about the increase or whatever it is of the death rate because of everything together, including the virus, and projections about what the death rate in total, the whole medical death rate, would be if we start to open up.
All right.
Yeah, so these are very hard questions, and I don't think we have data to show that. I do know that the death, I can say for sure, as you decrease social distancing, the number of deaths from coronavirus will increase. I think also that you may see decreases and increases in different conditions based upon what's going on. And I think that this is a complex problem and hard to completely disentangle, because right now I would say that trauma deaths are down from car accidents and violence. That's down. And so all these things kind of have cascading effects, and it's more of like a web of interactions, and it's not easy to, and not obvious sometimes to figure them all out. But we do know that this virus is here, and it's not going anywhere, and it's still going to continue the same behavior that it had beforehand. And we have to anticipate that there are going to be deaths that continue to accrue from this virus as social distancing recommendations are relaxed.
We only have 1 minute here. Let's go to Carrie in Albany. Carrie, about 30 seconds to pose your question.
Okay, thanks, guys, for taking my question. Really quickly, I'm over 65. I called my doctor to try to get a test to see if I had immunities. I was very sick in January, February, and she declined letting me get the test because she said it would not guarantee that I was immune to the virus and it would give me a false sense of security. So I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer.
Thank you very much. Doctor.
So with any infectious disease, once you've recovered and cleared the infection, you likely have a period where you are immune from reinfection. We don't know how long that lasts with this novel coronavirus, but we do suspect that it's likely going to be a period of several months to maybe a year where you cannot be really harmed by this virus. With other coronaviruses, we know we can experimentally reinfect individuals. We don't know this for that. For this virus, I think it's an important thing to study, but I do think that people who have immunity to it by an antibody likely are unable to get a severe infection from this for some period of time after their initial infection.
Well, Dr. Adalja, thank you so much for being here. We learned so very much, and it was great of you. I'm sure you're a little busy to give us a full hour, and we really appreciate it. Support comes from Empire Exhibits and Displays, Mechanicville, providing the greater Capital Region with exhibit design, fabrication, project management for trade shows, museums, and special events. Reopening for business Monday, May 18th, empireexhibits.com. Capital Roots, working year-round to provide nourishment, community, and a sense of belonging for individuals who call the Capital Region home. CapitalRoots.org to learn more. The Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz, an undergraduate theater program in liberal arts with concentrations in design and technology, theater studies and performance, newpaltz.edu/theatre. And Rhinebeck at New Paltz Artist Shops, professional picture framing and fine art materials, plus fine art at Atwater Gallery Kingston, Hudson Valley Artists Shops.com. Once again, thanks to Amish Adalja for joining us today on this edition of Vox Pop. Thank you for listening. Terrific calls today, terrific emails, and we really appreciate it. Thanks to, Jordan Yuxall, one of our higher-ups in the business department, answered the phones today, and he's wearing a mask because Zach's also in the room with him. Thanks to Zach, our engineer, who's also wearing a mask. Thanks to our producer, Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on the program, they were so popular last week, we're going to bring them back this week. Bob Graves will be back. Greg Ward this time. We'll talk gardening on the program tomorrow at 2. Stand by now for the book show.